Last week we dealt with the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. This is the foundation of the biblical story, those five books. Really nothing new happens after those five books. It's just the unpacking of what God has promised there. Even the gospel read back from the pages of the New Testament can be found in these five books. I mean, you don't have Christ on a cross, but you have the framework for the gospel there. I mean, it's in Deuteronomy that we're told that cursed is a man who hangs from a tree, and Paul brings that into the discussion about the gospel in Galatians. But we see the framework of what God is doing in history and the covenant, the promise that God gave to Abraham, that he is making a nation to bless all the other nations in the world. And then he calls his people to a covenant with him so that they may enjoy his blessings and may be that nation that blesses all the nations of the world. And that is right after the Exodus, in Exodus 19 and 20. And then he gives them a pattern for the way this life's going to look like. And he does it by giving them the dimensions of the tabernacle and instruction of the law and sacrifices to keep the relationship with their God because of sin. And so you have the framework there of this the biblical story. Now, we'll pick up today with Joshua, and we will try to get through the Old Testament today. And we begin to see this story move from the seed form, if you will, from the Pentateuch, and it's a messy story from this point. It's already been messy, but it just gets messier. We're going to do a little bit of Bible work in Joshua and Judges as we get started. I just want to show you some of the themes that we've been looking at. If you want to open up your Bibles to Joshua 3, Joshua is the conquest. The people of Israel have moved from the plains of Moab and are about to cross the Jordan River and begin the conquest of taking the land of Canaan. God has promised them he's going to give it to them. He's sending them into Canaan to take over this land. In Joshua 3, Israel crosses the Jordan. Pick up with me in Joshua 3:7. The Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all of Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priest who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan." And Joshua said to the people of Israel, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God." And Joshua said, "Here's how you shall know that the living God is among you, that he will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now, therefore, take the 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man, and when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap." So God has here, through the mouth of Joshua, repeated to the people of Israel that he is going with them and he is going to do something for them and that he is going to fulfill his promises to them. And he instructs them of what they're supposed to do to obey. And if you start just flipping through the book of Joshua. We won't look at every passage, of course. We just don't have time to do that. But you begin to see the unfolding of this story. And you look at Joshua 6. One of the first things that happens in this story is remarkable. God does this throughout history, redemptive history, over and over and over again. He doesn't save the best for last. When God makes a promise with his people, he does something to confirm that he is going to be faithful to his promise. He does things on the front end of the promise, and he does things following the promise. God has never left his people scratching their head, can we trust this guy? Can we trust the Lord? He's never left them that way. He always does remarkable things for his people to confirm that his word is true and they can trust him. He brings them through the Jordan River. He does a remarkable thing there by holding back the waters. He gets them into the land of Canaan. And one of the very first things that happens is the fall of Jericho. We all remember that story when we were kids. And how amazing it is that they basically take over a city by walking around it seven times and blowing trumpets. But what God is doing here is saying, I'm going to be the one who gives you the land. And you can trust me. This is not going to come from your power and your might because you're stronger and you're better warriors than the nations. It's because I'm your God. And because I'm your God, I'm going to give you the land, and you're going to be a witness to the nations about me. And then that's the story of Joshua from this point. It just moves on, and there's covenant renewal, and there's conquest. And we also see signs in the story where the people of Israel aren't faithful at all points. They don't do everything God tells them to do. I mean, it's a gruesome sort of thing. He tells them to go into these lands to kill everyone and to smash the idols and for no one to survive. And there's little signs in the story that they're not faithful. They don't do exactly what God tells them to do. If you go to the end of Joshua 23. Joshua, in chapter 23, he gives a final charge to the leaders of Israel. I'm going to read this whole chapter. And one of the reasons I'm doing this is I want you to see that this is tied to the main story. This is not just some strange thing that's happening, you know, two-thirds of the way through the Old Testament. This is tied to the grand story that we're talking about. Joshua says this: a long time afterwards, when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their surrounding enemies, Joshua was old and well advanced in years. And Joshua summoned all of Israel, its elders and heads, and its judges and officers, and said to them, I am now old and well advanced in years, and you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. For it is the Lord your God who has fought for you. Behold, I have allotted to you as an inheritance for your tribes, these nations that remain, along with all the nations that I have already cut off, from the Jordan to the great sea in the west. And the Lord your God will push them back before you and drive them out of your sight. And you shall possess their land, just as the Lord your God has promised. Therefore, be very strong to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, turning aside from it neither to the right hand or to the left, that you may not mix with these nations remaining among you and make mention of the names of their gods, or swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. But you shall cling to the Lord your God, just as you have done to this day. For the Lord has driven out before you the great and strong nations. And as for you, no man has been able to stand before you to this day. One man of you puts to flight 1,000, since it is the Lord your God who fights for you, just as he promised you. That's the principle I was just talking about. God is doing remarkable things to demonstrate that it's him that's doing the work. And Joshua captures it this way: one man of you puts to flight 1,000. Why? To demonstrate that it's the Lord your God who fights for you. Be very careful, therefore, to love the Lord your God. For if you turn back and cling to the remnant of these nations remaining among you and make marriage with them so that you associate with them and they with you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. But they shall be a snare and a trap for you, a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes, and until you perish from off this good ground that the Lord your God has given you. And now I am about to go the way of all the earth, and you know in your hearts and souls, all of you, that not one word has failed of all the good things that the Lord your God promised concerning you. All have come to pass for you, not one of them has failed. But just as all good things that the Lord your God promised concerning you has been fulfilled, so the Lord will bring about all the evil things until he has destroyed you off this good land that the Lord your God has given you, if you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and you shall perish quickly from off the good land that he has given to you. You have Joshua here just reaffirming to them that God has made a covenant with you. He's established that covenant through Abraham and the words of Moses. And God has done great things. You've demonstrated. He's demonstrated his power and his faithfulness. He's done great things before you. Now, as you move out from this point, that's the way Joshua says it. I'm going the way of the earth. I'm about to die. And as you move out from this point, you've got to stay faithful to the covenant. God has demonstrated himself faithful to you. And that's the way the book of Joshua ends. And then the next book is the book of Judges. And the whole book of Judges is a story of the fact that the people of Israel didn't heed the words of Joshua. We learn in the opening pages of the book of Judges, and Judges chapter 2, and that Israel's heart is a heart of disobedience. If you look with me in the first few verses of Judges chapter 2, we see that now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bakshan, and he said, I brought you up from Egypt, and I brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I'll never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is it that you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their God shall be a snare to you. As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to the people lifted up their voices and wept. And they called the name of the place Bakshan, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. So you have, just in the very first pages of Judges, God confronts the people and said, you've been disobedient. And this begins the story of the nation of Israel. They're disobedient, God confronts them, and they repent. And the rest of the Old Testament follows that line. And God says, because you've been disobedient, I'm going to leave these people in Canaan to be a test to you. And we're going to see what your real heart's really made of. And Joshua tells them, starting in chapter 2, verse 16 through chapter 3, that this is going to be the pattern. He said, I'm going to leave these people to be a test to you, but I'm going to show grace to you. I'm going to give you a judge, and the judge is going to be there to protect you. And that's what the whole book of Judges is about. It's about the traps and the snares and the tests that are around the people of Israel, and how God uses these judges in crazy ways. If you've never read the book of Judges, you ought to. There is crazy stories in there. This one dude stabs a really fat guy with a sword, and he loses the sword. I mean, if you've got a son, go home and read that story to him. He'll love it. I mean, it's crazy. All sorts of crazy things in the book of Judges. That's where we find the story of Samson in the book of Judges, and that's a crazy story. You got a dude that kills a bunch of people with the jawbone of a donkey. It's just a crazy, crazy thing. But what God is doing through the book of Judges is he's showing grace to the people of Israel by raising up a judge who does just remarkable things to save the people, but he's also demonstrating to the people that your heart's not for me. And that's why you have this refrain throughout the book of Judges that there's not a king in Israel and the people are doing things their own way. So you have this refrain throughout, and it's pointing to us something significant, and that is that the people's hearts are wicked. I mean, it's just a pretty obvious point, but the whole book of Judges is to point to us that the people's hearts are wicked, and even though God has done great things for his people, their hearts aren't. Their hearts aren't molded and aren't shaped to love God, but to disobey God. So the book of Judges sets up the need for the people to have a king, and it sets up the cry of the people at the beginning of 1 Samuel for a king. And through the story of the Judges, some things happen that begin to undo the conquest and what God has done for the people of Israel. Because one thing that happens in the book of Judges is the Philistines come in and they defeat the Israelites and they take the Ark of the Covenant away from the people. So the book of Samuel begins. The Ark of the Covenant is not with the people. Then that was the sign of God's presence with his people. It's the way God demonstrated that he dwells with them. So the Ark of the Covenant is not with them. And the people are not prospering. People are not growing. People aren't prospering. And it's a really dark, dark time in the nation of Israel. So you have the book of Samuel, and it begins. Go with me to the first chapter of Samuel. It begins with the birth of Samuel, and Samuel coming on the scene. But we're told in the second chapter we have Hannah's prayer. She prayed and said, exalting the Lord for looking upon her and giving her a son. So you have this. It begins with the birth of Samuel and Hannah's prayer and worship to God for giving her a son. And what you have here is you have kind of a literary symbolism of where Israel was. They were basically a barren people, and God begins to show hope through the birth of Samuel, raising someone up that can lead the nation. And so the story of Hannah is kind of a parable for the nation of Israel. And the fact that Samuel is born shows signs of hope there. And it's interesting, and when you go to the New Testament and you read in the first couple of chapters in Luke, that what Hannah says there in her prayer, Mary repeats after she hears that she's going to be giving birth to a son. And there's a lot of similarities between what Mary says in Luke 2, and what Hannah says in the first part of Samuel. So the people begin to cry out, "We need a king." Because what they're seeing is that all the nations around them are stronger, more powerful, and they begin to get threatened by those nations. And if you remember the promise that God gave to Abraham, you know that that's not the way it was supposed to go, right? The way it was supposed to go is that this nation was supposed to be blessed by God. It was supposed to grow and be a mighty nation. And this nation was supposed to bless all the other nations. And what we see here at this part of the story of the people of God is that they are now looking at the other nations and they're threatened by them. And so what they do is they go to God and they complain and they say, we now need a king. But the problem with it is that they said, we need a king like the nations have. So instead of the people of God looking, being the witness to the nations that they have a covenant-making God who is with them, and he demonstrates his presence with them through their blessing and their strength and their obedience to him, these people have been threatened by the nations around them, and they're looking at the nations and say, we need to be more like them. And instead of realizing that, in fact, they do have a king, and the king is the Lord their God, they say, we need a king like the kings of the nations, and God gives them that king. And what God does to the nations, he gives them a king like they want. God had already told them in Deuteronomy chapter 17 that if they were to have a king, what this king needs to look like. And in Deuteronomy chapter 17, it tells us that if you have a king, you should have a king who knows my word, who loves my word, and who makes sure that the people know and love my word. And he's a servant king. So he's already given them a provision for a king if they were to need a king. But the people say, we don't want your provisions for a king, God. We want a king like we want. And they looked at the nations and said, we want a king after like the kings of the nations. And God gives them that in the person of Saul. So God chooses Saul. But he doesn't choose Saul according to his plan for his nations, but according to their plan. And we know that Saul rules unfaithfully. God puts his hand upon Saul, but then he finally ultimately takes his hands off Saul. And in the middle of the story of Saul, we have this other incredible story in the Old Testament, and that's the story of David. And in the midst of Saul's failures, and in the midst of Saul's disobedience and not leading faithfully, God shows us a little boy who's a shepherd boy, and he takes a slingshot and he goes and kills a giant of the Philistines. So right in the middle of that story, and what we learn from that story is this: that the people need a king that God has anointed, not that they have anointed. The story of David and Goliath is this: God's hand is upon David. He has anointed him. He has given him strength. He has provided for him and his victories. And that's the reason that story is located where it is. If you look with me in 1 Samuel, First Samuel 16 and 17, it's just sandwiched right in the middle of really the story about Saul and Saul's disobedience and what God is doing to take his spirit away from Saul. And God raises up another one who's going to lead. And God ultimately takes his spirit away from Saul and anoints David as a man after his own heart to be the king of Israel. And then things get pretty good after that. I mean, if you read the first couple of chapters of 2 Samuel, and you're moving from 2 Samuel to up to like 2 Samuel 9 or 10, man, things are great. The nation is defeating other nations, and the kingdom is growing, the boundaries of the kingdom are growing. Things are really, really good.